I would like to know how many of you opened up your bulletin this morning and saw the scripture reading, and the first thing you thought was, "Dear Lord, he printed out the Bible." Good, good. A lot of these books were intended to be read publicly, especially ones with a poetic flow like Ecclesiastes. And so sometimes I like to read these large swaths so that it kind of washes over us. It's almost meant to get a feel for what the author is saying more than kind of pick apart the details. And so as I read, let it wash over you. Because these are the words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. "Vanity of vanities," says the teacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What do people gain from their toil, at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and it goes to the north. Round and around it goes, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they continue to flow. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been, it's what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing which is said, 'See, this is new'? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them. I, the teacher, when king over Israel in Jerusalem, applied my mind to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to be busy with. I saw all the deeds that are done under heaven, and see, all is vanity, a chasing after the wind. I said to myself, 'I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has had great experience of wisdom and of knowledge. And I applied my mind to wisdom and to know madness and folly and perceive that this also is but a chasing after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And those who increase in knowledge increase in sorrow. I said to myself, come now, I will make a test of pleasure, even enjoy yourself. But again, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly, until I might see what was good for mortals to do under heaven. During the few days of their life, I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water and forests of growing trees. I brought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, the treasures of kings and of provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and delighted of the flesh and many concubines. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom, it remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had spent doing it. And again, all was vanity, a chasing after the wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can one do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise have eyes in their head, but the fools walk in darkness. Yet I perceived that the same fate falls on all of them. So then I said to myself, what happens to the fool will also happen to me. Why then have I been so very wise? I said to myself, this is vanity. For there is no enduring remembrance of the wise or the fool, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. So how can the wise just die like fools? And I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity, a chasing after the wind. I hated all of my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to those who come after me, and who knows, they might be wise or foolish. Yet they will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned and gave my heart up to wisdom and knowledge, and skill must leave all to be enjoyed by another who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What do mortals know from all the toil and strain with which they toil under the sun? For all their days are full of pain. Their work is a vexation. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This is vanity. So there is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their work. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he gives work of gathering and reaping. Only give to the one who pleases God. But this also is vanity, a chasing after the wind. So upon hearing all of this, people generally have one reaction. What in the world is going on? Here, I mean, most of us came to get something different. Why? We could watch 20 minutes of cable news if we wanted to heap on a bit of nihilistic pessimism. But come on, we're thinking, this is church, right? Give me some gospel. Give me some good news. You know what I mean? And that's fair. Because oftentimes, we don't know what to do with a book like this. But that's also the point. This book, it begins by describing a teacher, but the word here, it actually means like a master teacher. It's someone who gathers many people together. It's not just someone who's passing on knowledge. This is a master, someone who gives so that there will be real change. And what master teachers do is they begin with a bit of confusion and disorientation. They want to surprise you in a way that screws up your categories, that pulls the ideological rug out from under where it was, so that once you're shaky and confused and have a sense of like, oh, I'm not sure, I don't like this, then you're actually ready to step into something new, a new way of seeing the world, a new way of accepting something you could not accept or hear or understand before. Side note, this is also what Jesus is constantly doing, especially when he's talking in parables, the ones that confuse and upset people. Jesus is also a master teacher who is basically ending people's expectations when he teaches. Something like, oh, you think you know who God loves? Well, let me tell you a story about a Samaritan and a rabbi. Or, oh, you want to know how to be alive? Then you need to die. Die to yourself, to all of this. Oh, and by the way, it's the meek and the poor and those who hunger and thirst for justice and all those other people who you really don't want to be, they're the blessed ones in this. Jesus and the writer of Ecclesiastes, they understand each other. They're on the same page. Because if a teacher is just telling us things we already know, or, dare I say, if a preacher is just confirming what we already believe, do we really need them at all in the first place? The soil, in a sense, must be upturned for new seed to be planted. You know what I mean? And so, right away, this book jumps headfirst into the subversive and the countercultural. It wants to make you squirm and have kind of a sense of, I'm not so sure about this. So first off, I want us to look at one of the very first words that comes up. What is a word that you heard as you were listening? Say it again. Vanity, right? This has also been translated as meaningless, as futility. In the Hebrew, it is the word havel. Everyone say havel. Havel is literally mist. It's vapor, it's smoke. It's also a sense of breath. It's that which is here and is real, and you kind of have to deal with it at some level, but it has no real substance. It's temporary. It is simply mist, right? And so, the teacher is pointing out the nature of havel in all things. This idea of things that are so temporary that if you pulled back the veil, if you went to 10,000 feet and got the big picture, you'd see that much of it has no real worth because of it. And for the teacher, again, everything under the sun, basically everything in the created realm, is havel. Houses, havel. Horses, havel. Silver, havel. Your 401k, havel, though you might already feel like that. Wisdom, havel. Thoughts, havel. Education, havel. Understanding, havel. This in State College is a disruptive thing to say. Or how about this? Your religious beliefs and the idea of having your mental furniture arranged in the right way, havel. Or your political affiliations, super havel. It's all mist. Trees, flags, mountains, stars, moons, sun, generations, your legacy, art, your reputation. It's all havel. And at the center of understanding where the teacher is going with this is this sense that at some point, all of it will cease to be or to be remembered. At some point, everything that seems too big to fail will become so small that it is less than a word in a book that has been burned. Smoke. Mist. Secondly, we see this phrase that tends to go along with it, a chasing after the wind. Again, it tends to be cleaned up. We tend to clean up the nuances in the translation from the original Hebrew. But a more literal translation would be something like a shepherding of the wind. It is this image of people trying to capture and control or keep that which cannot be captured or controlled. It is the image of us taking the mist and doing our best to decide what it does because of what we think we need it to do. So much of life tends to feel like we're attempting to shepherd the wind, doesn't it? Or like the wind needs to be. And so why is this important? Because for most of us, the biggest questions of life is how do I manage the stuff in it so that I can get, do, accomplish, care for, protect, live up to, justify what I need to. And this is what most wisdom literature, the genre that books like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes belong to. Oftentimes, wisdom literature is set up to help us navigate the questions. It is an image of a path or a road, and we're on the road, and there keeps being these forks in it. And so wisdom literature is generally set up to have the teacher give us instruction about which way to go on that fork. And generally, there is the way of wisdom and the way of foolishness, right? And the way of wisdom leads to blessings and to life, like real lived life, right? And to good things and to legacy and all the stuff we actually want. And foolishness, well, that leads somewhere else, the opposite. So usually the teacher is telling us how if you do A, you get B, and that leads to C, right? If you read the book of Proverbs, that's basically the whole thing. The wise one does this, the foolish one does this. The simple do this, the foolish do this. But that is not what the master teacher in this book is doing. This teacher is writing to all of you who actually did the right thing, who chose the wisdom path, who played by the rules, and you tried your best with everything that you had, but life still smashed you in the face. Or, and this might be a lot more true for some of us, it's for those of us who did all the wrong things, who made destructive choices for the wrong reasons, who dived headfirst into some kind of foolishness, but then we hit a wall, and we fell into a pit, and there we encountered the unexpected and inexplainable grace of God, the one who loves us. And that is where we are handed a lifeline or a new opportunity that ended up leading to something better than we ever imagined or planned in the first place. Somehow, our foolishness led to more good. Ecclesiastes is a book for all of us, for whom the nice, neat categories, they stopped working a long time ago, because life, at some point, it smashed us open and it didn't play fair, and we saw that. Because you might make all the wise choices and be morally superior in every way, but the idiot may win more and die after you anyways. And you can make all the wrong choices, and it still leads you to an unimaginable grace. So there's Havel, the vapor. And there is shepherding the wind. And then in chapter 2, the teacher says this phrase towards the beginning, yet when I consider the work of my hands, right? He made great vineyards and parks, a perfect house and hobbies. He's got hotties with bodies and every other approval people can give, and a career perfection with tenure, all the protections, and even wisdom with religious flawlessness. But then there is this moment in chapter 2, when the teacher stops and says, yet, when I consider the work of my hands. This is essentially his brutal and unflinching self-examination. Because how many of us, somewhere in the back of our heads, have this sense of, if I just, that's driving us forward. If I just had a little more money, if I was just a little bit smarter, if I could just lose a few more pounds, if I just had different parents, if my spouse, if they would just, if my boss would just, and we hold it all assuming that real happiness or peace or joy is somehow on the other side of those things. But on the other side of everything we thought we wanted, is often still this kind of existential, nagging sense of not enoughness. Side note, I think that this is what makes perfectionism its own special kind of torture. Because I remember back when I was in high school, and my school had a very big culture of football. I know you guys can't relate, but that's how it was. And I don't know how it is in high school here, but for us, we had a very small school in which our claim to fame, our golden years, were in the early 2000s, in which we won conference championships 4 years in a row. So by the time I was in my sophomore year, I knew that it was every single varsity player's dream to do it again. And in fact, I distinctly remember talking about it one day with Kyle George. He was a big deal. And as he was standing at this table, I can't remember what led to it, but at one point in the middle of our lunchroom, he gets up on the top of it in his game day jersey with his arms stretched out, and he begins to yell, "And when we win, we shall be legends." And it was this ridiculous high school moment in which everybody started clapping for him in agreement, right? Somehow everyone agreed, yes, you will be legend. It was like this ancient tribal ritual that everyone just knew what to do. Senior, game day, jersey, ridiculous over-the-top proclamation, we all clap as the symbol of our collective hopes and dreams. So about a week later was the conference championship game. And we did win. And so I found myself sitting across from Kyle again, and I asked him, how does it feel waiting to experience kind of all of life's glories vicariously through him? But instead, he just shrugs. And he said, with this kind of bored, my leg still hurts. And I said, what? And he replied, yeah, whatever, it's over now. And at the moment, my 14-year-old brain just, it could not handle it, right? But how many of us have been in the same space? How many of us have actually got the thing that we wanted? How many of us were actually able to shepherd the vapor? But it still felt like nothing. Havel, Havel, all is Havel, a shepherding the wind. And then, at the end of chapter 2, this phrase breaks the rhythm of the teacher's words. There is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? It is like this thing that sits on the edges of this book. The word there used for God is literally the most general phrase for God there can possibly be. It's a phrase that's even used when talking about foreign gods. It is essentially saying that which is uncreated. And it sits at the edge of what he is saying. Peering into the created mist to pull the camera back with a few simple phrases. And so this is what I think the teacher is getting at. Do you remember a number of years ago, there were a number of Chilean miners who their mine had collapsed and they got stuck and they got trapped in there. And I think they were in there for over a month, right? And you can imagine buried in the earth, in the dark, having no idea what's happening above you. A number of them had said, we were dead men who were conveniently already buried. And so I remember seeing these pictures of them coming up out of this hole in this little tube. And the moment they walk out, there is this huge smile, this grin on their face. And the first thing they do is they turn and they just start hugging people, right? As many as they can get their hands on. Do you think he was thinking about how this might affect his 401k? Do you think he was considering these people who had wronged him and maybe how to get back at them? Do you think he was thinking about anything else other than the pure joy of that moment, which was fully present, uncompromising, and all-encompassing, overwhelming his awareness that life is a precious gift to be appreciated and enjoyed? Not worrying about earning or validating or proving worthy or living up or accomplishing or paying back anything. At this moment, there is a sense in each of them that this breath I take, this is gift at its core, to be appreciated and enjoyed. This, I think, is what is at the center of what the teacher is getting at. What is life? It is gift. And the problem is that most people spend most of their lives and energy trying to get better at shepherding their wind. We spend most of our lives tearing at ourselves or trying to control or manipulate that which was never ours to control or live up to in the first place. This belief that somehow, somewhere, there is this universal standard we're supposed to meet. But it's turned into a kind of slavery that is sucking the life out of us. And many people even come to faith in the hopes that someone with some kind of authority will fix our vapor. That it will give them the thing that they've been saying, if I just had, about a better marriage, a better job, a fix to a broken heart. We want to be told what we need to do to get our vapor managed and our wind shepherded in. Because we assume that somehow, if we can do that, it'll lead us to another place of peace and calm and joy. But I would offer that what Jesus came to do is to awaken and enliven and invite us to the fact that we don't need to twist ourselves into knots of striving and fighting for that which we have already been given. The grace that has already arrived as a free gift. And in my experience, there are two ways that people come to this realization. Either life has been taken from them, or they got everything that they wanted and were left with a sense of, is that it? Right? I've known a number of people, maybe a number of you, who have had cancer. And in that moment, things got really simple. And this felt really precious. And each day started to feel like something else, even if there was a bit of fear in the background. And those of you who got what you were expecting and then realized, this isn't actually what I wanted. The teacher is saying to us, look at me, I got it all. But this is all that I was left with. Vapor. Vapor. Like trying to shepherd the wind. And so when Jesus tells us things like, seek first the kingdom of God, what we often hear is, do, 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 get to work, because Jesus is coming. But I would offer that what he really means is to set our awareness on the bigger, uncreated reality of gift that sits at the center of all of it. That to seek first is to seek this deep understanding of grace and gift. And then everything else will be given to you. Because when your life begins to revolve around this, well, then you have a way to actually deal with the vapor. And dare I say, even enjoy it. Because when it's all gift, forgiveness starts to make much more sense. Why carry it around? I don't need this. It's just vapor. I can let it go. When it's all gift, sacrifices, they take less effort. Sure, this was a gift to me. I can give it as a gift to this other person. When it's all gift, those relationships, you realize they can go away at any time. And they are to be enjoyed and treasured now, as much as possible. When it's all gift, losing a job isn't a tragedy that talks about who we are as people. It's just how this works. And another one will come. I can move on. I can give myself to something that my employer can't touch, that no one can touch. You live as if your life is either an expression of a gift you've already received, or we live because we are searching for something else, and everything becomes a tool to get there. A vapor, a gift you get to hold, or it is a tool to try and get somewhere else. What the master teacher is inviting you into is a starting point, free of charge or demand. This grace at the center of all of it from the beginning, that all you need is this. Everything you need, you already possess. And when you tap into that, you tap into all that is in the uncreated. You tap into a kingdom that is not of this world. You begin a relationship with the divine that is rooted in gratefulness and peace and joy. This is where freedom begins. May you feel the gift, and may it grow in everything you do. Amen.